From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford. I'm here with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Mama Pope.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. We're talking about young kids going to school today.
We are.
You got to put on your Mama Pope.
I am a mom of three kids. I had to make this decision of what to do with them early on.
Yeah.
In fact, it's one of the questions I get asked the most, even though this is not necessarily my specialty area, but people will say to me, I have a five-year-old and his birthday is in October. Do I send him to kindergarten or do I not? Or he's super mature, but he's really small for his age. So should we send him or not send him? And I get these questions all the time.
How do you answer? It's tough because, you know, one size doesn't fit all.
Well, that's basically what I say, yeah. Right? One size doesn't fit all. And I do know when people are asking for the wrong reasons, right? So we want him to go to Harvard and play football at, you know, USC. So we're waiting till he's 7 and a half before we send him
steroids.
To. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's the things people say are really crazy. There's this other group where they literally went to Harvard and they asked the admissions people at Harvard, who are your biggest feeder high schools? Where do the most Harvard undergrads come from? Which high schools? And then they went to those high schools and they said, where do most of your kids feed from? What schools? What junior highs, elementary schools? And to the point where they went to the elementary schools, I'm not making this up. There's a whole article on this. And they said, where do your kids go to preschool that go to these schools that ultimately end up at Harvard?
Wow.
And they literally were trying to backwards plan their kids' lives.
Wow.
Into what's called, you know, basically those preschools ended up being called the baby Ivies, right? Because they were the sort of feeders to the world of the Ivies. And they're really expensive and really hard to get into. And you have to put your kid on a wait list before you're even pregnant, basically, to get in. Crazy.
Yeah, I think my attitude was more laissez-faire.
With your own son?
Yeah. So I was a single dad, and I faced that decision about, you know, wait a year or enroll him into kindergarten. How do you think I made the decision?
Well, tell me when's his birthday? What month?
I'm not allowing anybody to track down this poor kid.
Okay, that's fair. I think you made the decision on what was the closest to your house and how early they could take him so you could get to work.
Very close. I did it. Slightly different, but purely instrumental.
Yeah.
It was kindergarten's free.
Right.
So I put him into kindergarten.
Oh, so you know, right? So preschool you'd have to pay for.
That's right.
Kindergarten's
That's right.
free, so he's going.
Yeah. But you know, sure enough, he didn't get into Harvard. There you go.
I will tell you, I'm an October birthday. And so I was always like the last in my class to get a driver's license or the last in my class to turn 21, right? And I have a kid with an October birthday, and I thought we were going to have this whole super hard decision, send her or not. She's a middle kid, super mature. She was the earliest reader out of all my kids. And it turns out that they changed the requirement in our school. It said September 1st. If it's before September 1st, they go. And if it's after, you hold them a year. So Allie got held a year. And to this day, she still says, I'm so much more mature than other people in my grade because I held her for that 1 year. Like, she's never let us forget it.
She's like 60 now. Right?
Yeah, she's practically. Yeah. How old do you think I am? Yeah, exactly. So, no, I'm really excited that we have a wonderful expert with us today. Tom D is a professor with us at the Graduate School of Education. He's also the director of the Stanford Center for Education Policy Analysis, which we call SEPA here. That's our shortcut name for it here at the Graduate School of Education. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, very excited. And Tom, you actually have studied this phenomenon. Now, I need to give this definition because you studied something called redshirting.
Right.
And redshirting, I looked it up. So I know you hear redshirting in terms of colleges and athletics, right? So it turns out that years ago, they put the athletes in red shirts who they were holding out for the year. So they weren't playing them. They were letting them develop and all that. But now it turns out that redshirting has been adopted by the kindergarten crowd. So tell us more.
Sure. Yeah. It's something that's become increasingly popular both in the U.S. and also in other developed nations. I mean, historically in the U.S., five-year-olds were in kindergarten and six-year-olds were in first grade. But we've seen this trend to where something like 15 to 20% of kindergartners are now 6 years old. And it tends to be the children of more affluent families who are perhaps thinking about how can I game my child's way to Harvard. And also it tends to be boys. And so there's a popular sense out there that kids gain a developmental advantage from these sorts of delays. You hear the phrase that we used in the title of our study, giving kids the gift of time. But actually, the evidence has really suggested it wasn't the case. So I think part of what's going on here is there's some popular science that I think has been misconstrued. And not to pick on Malcolm Gladwell, as people often seem to want to do.
Oh, you can pick on him. This is Sirius XM.
That's right. We could even use profanity if we wanted, though I will choose
not to. Try not to do that.
But in his popular book, Outliers, there's this famous anecdote involving elite athletes in Canadian hockey, where apparently there's a calendar year cutoff rule for organizing cohorts in their kind of pipeline of training elite hockey players. And so what he noted you observed, if you look at the more mature teams, is that the kids on those elite teams are highly overrepresented from the first quarter of the calendar year. And the argument is that when these kids enter the pipeline, they're older than the kids who were born later in the year.
Yeah.
And it starts this recursive process of they seem to be doing well, they get more attention, they get more praise, et cetera. And it just redounds to their future development.
Isn't it also because they are just physically bigger because they're older?
They are. That's right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think anecdotes like that have kind of given people this sense that there might be really meaningful educational and even long-run economic gains to delaying kids' entry into formal schooling. But actually, the literature that looks outside of hockey and looks instead at what kids have learned and how well they're sort of advancing through schools and even long-run labor market outcomes haven't found clean evidence of that. And this literature has gone down some blind paths because if you were to naively just look at third grade test scores and look at those who were redshirted, those who delayed kindergarten, those who didn't, the kids who delayed would seem to be better. But we've realized that a lot of that is just that they're older.
Right, developmental maturity.
Right, so we need to separate sort of the age at which we might be giving them a test from these other confounds. The really careful literature that has looked at this has found that, if anything, there might be some negative effects associated with this. But anyway, this was sort of my point of entry. We had this empirical puzzle, right? Parents seemed to believe there were meaningful developmental advantages to delaying the start of formal schooling. But the research base hadn't really found evidence of that. So it occurred to me as I started digging into, well, why do people think there are advantages, that we might have been looking in the wrong place? I mean, we reflexively look at test scores and educational attainment. But if you sort of start to unpackage, in particular, how developmental psychologists think about the gains of delaying school, the first thing they come to isn't sort of cognitive performance. It's really about sort of other measures of psychological adaptation. And in fairness, my training as an economist, so for me, this was a bit of an intellectual journey as well.
We won't hold that against you.
Yeah, thank you.
I do.
Okay, Dan does. Sorry, Dan does.
I understand we're a necessary evil to some extent. But anyway, the developmental psychologists talk about how play is really an important part of child development, and in particular, the name Vygotsky is often thrown around here. And the claim is that giving kids extended experience with play-based environments, in particular, will help them develop strong self-regulation skills that will redound to psychological well-being and ultimately longer-run success, we think.
All right. We are going to unpack that. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Tom Dee, who is the director of the Stanford Center for Education Policy Analysis here at the Graduate School of Education. And Tom, you just said a bunch of words that I think our audience may need some unpacking. Self-regulation. What does self-regulation mean?
Yeah, essentially it means the capacity to not be too fidgety, to stay on focus, to bring attention to sort of what you're doing, your engagement with your learning environment, et cetera.
So lots of adults have a self-regulation problem too.
Did you say something?
So when you're looking at this and you talked about the importance of play, you mentioned Vygotsky, who's a famous educator. Talk to us the relationship between play, Vygotsky, and self-regulation.
Yeah, Vygotsky's known for several insights, but the one that's really on point here is around play. And he stressed the importance of play in development. And there's this – I'm going to misquote it slightly, but there was this great phrase he had where in play it's as if the child were a head taller. And the idea is that when you're engaging in play, you're trying on the habits of older children, of older adults, because you have to both create a fictive environment but then inhibit that in particular ways. I mean, the example I often use when I talk about this is if you decide this banana is a phone and I'm going to play with it as a phone, well, then you have to impose the properties of a phone on that banana. And so that's creating some self-regulatory skills for children.
Just to interrupt a little bit.
Yeah.
So the theory goes.
Right.
So they've had a very difficult time showing the consequences of play in humans.
Right.
In part because it's very hard to lock a kid in a closet and say, don't play.
Right.
And so this is a particular theory that getting to pretend things helps you inhibit and not be responsive to the stimulus of the world, but more responsive to your mind.
Yeah.
And so that's the claim. But this is sort of an argument not that you should start school late, but that maybe school should just be filled with lots of play in kindergarten.
That's right. I like to stress that to people because when they walk up to this literature, their first question is, what should I do for my child?
Yeah.
Should I delay their
school
entry?
Tell me what the answer is.
Whichever's cheaper.
but as researchers, practitioners, policymakers, we should also be wondering about what is the environment they encounter when they get to school, regardless of what age. And I think in the coming years, I mean, we've talked about this offline, how there's this growing trend towards personalization in medicine, in shopping, et cetera. And I expect it's going to creep into education as the data become richer, more digital, et cetera. We're going to have the capacity to personalize learning environments, curriculum, et cetera. So I think putting on our
– I have an alternative to that, to the personalization that's relevant to redshirting. I think we should have a National Procreation Day.
And so everyone has a kid on the same day.
That's right. Solve it once and for all.
And that way everyone is the same age when they start school, when they learn how to drive. The DMV would have a heart attack.
Right. So the hospital would have
hospital.
A conveyor belt for like a week.
Yeah.
And then that wing would shut down.
I'm picturing like I Love Lucy with the candy, but like all the babies coming out. Oh, my gosh. That's so crazy. I don't think that's going to work. Dan, just sorry to rain on your
parade.
Well,
there are parents who time procreation with respect to getting their kid into Harvard.
I know that there are parents who time procreation for a whole bunch of reasons, but there are crazy people.
So this is
Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Tom D about sort of crazy people who
we are talking with Tom D about redshirting.
Whether you hold back a kid to go into kindergarten so that they're older with the alleged outcome being better academics, better social skills, better overall. And Tom, your study has shown.
Get us to the results. What'd you find?
Yeah, so we found, and in some sense it was the result that drove me back to thinking about theoretically what was going on. But what we found was that kids who were delaying the start of formal schooling, the start of kindergarten, and this was situated in Denmark for reasons I could describe, had later in childhood at age 7 and even later at age 11 much better levels of self-regulation. There's a very widely used kind of psychological screening device that has multiple constructs to it. One of them is a measure of inattention and hyperactivity, essentially the inverse of self-regulation. And we found that kids who were quasi-randomly assigned to start formal schooling later were substantially better, but only on that narrow construct. And for those of you who think statistically, the effect size here was 0.7 standard deviations, which if you don't think statistically, that's big.
That's huge.
In a field
setting. So it's not that they were just more mature.
That's right. And the reason we can be sure of this is the way our design worked is we leveraged the cutoff rule. right? There's a birthday threshold, and kids on one side of it tend to start school later. Kids on the other side start earlier, right? But they're otherwise observationally equivalent. We could see that in the data. They're very similar in terms of family background, et cetera.
So just to summarize, the kids who started a year later were showing benefits down the line. And
right.
So this is
long
sort of,
term.
Yeah, this is kind of the elusive grail in education, is to be able to make claims over many years.
Yeah.
To show these effects that show up early.
Right.
So I'm going to play the role of a skeptic here.
Oh, we love that.
Didn't Denmark, aren't they like the happiest nation in the world? It just came out that they're like the happiest people. So
they're also pretty homogenous, right?
That's right.
And they also don't they have universal health care and child care?
That's right.
I love Denmark. I have friends from Denmark. No, but the question is, do we feel comfortable generalizing this finding to the U.S.?
Yeah, no, that's a totally legitimate question. And there's always going to be a bit of an asterisk. I should begin by saying, why did we even study Denmark? And this is occurring throughout the social sciences. They have such unusually rich linked data in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, et cetera. In this case, we could follow kids later in life but match them to their birth records and their birth date, the kinds of things that would be fiendishly difficult to do in the U.S. So yes, there's a bit of an asterisk about that just because it's Denmark, but also because what we could think of as the control condition. What are kids doing if they're not starting kindergarten is so homogenous there. They've got fairly structured, standardized, universal daycare there. Now, as a researcher, I tend to think of that as a feature, not a bug, because it creates kind of a clean contrast between
what the kids are doing.
Right? But in the U.S., it's much more of a grab bag. Younger kids who aren't starting kindergarten, some are in home care, some are in center-based care. So there's, you know, that's why any one parent should be cautious in thinking about what's right for my child.
I think what's really hard as a parent is you've got multiple kids and you don't want to mess any single one of them up, but you have different situations for different kids, right? Depending on birthdays and depending on maturity. And I hear all the time, I don't want my kid to be bored. She already knows how to read.
Right.
What am I going to do with her for a year? To the point of he is so not ready to sit and listen to a teacher. He's going to be in the discipline office every day.
Yeah, and when I'm pressed to give advice to parents, the first thing I say to them is, well, the literature, what I found is suggesting if there are benefits, it's really going to be around this self-regulation dimension. So think about your child, where they are now with regard to that. Trust your own judgment and crowdsource some wisdom. Talk to other parents you know. Talk to teachers to try to form a holistic picture. But that'll also include understanding if my child does or doesn't go to kindergarten, what kind of environment are they going to be in? And how does that possibly dovetail with where I'd like to see them go over the next year or two?
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Janice Pope. We are going to have more with Tom D and Redshirting Your Kindergartner right after this on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Tom D., who is a professor here in the Graduate School of Education and the director of the Stanford Center for Education Policy Analysis. We call that CEPA. And we are talking about redshirting and how parents make that decision about whether to send their kid to kindergarten or to hold them back for a year.
So I don't want to just be practical about this. Tom's study is quite interesting for a different reason, which is to track the effects of early things for a child much later in life has been very difficult. You know, you think in the medical practice, they have the Johnny jump up in the door. You know, does the kid spring up and down? And you sort of want to know 40 years from now, is that kid's knees going to be blown out because he was like doing this in the doorway when he was like two?
Lots of moms are crying right now, Dan. Wait, I messed up my kid's knees.
That's okay. They'll be past their prime athletic years. But so this is sort of a new thing to be able to do this, right? And this data set made this available. So there's kind of two questions. So let me ask the first one. This is kind of an existence proof. You have shown for the first time that there is this very selective effect that if you go later, it shows up in a very particular way, selectively, for your ability to inhibit behavior, to be more disciplined when you're interacting socially.
Which is a good thing. That's usually considered a positive when you're 11 you can self-regulate. Moms would want their kids to be able to do that.
No, that is a good thing. Okay. And unless you become over the top and you like become constipated and you can't do stuff because you're so tight.
To over-regulation is not good.
But let us stay in the space where this
carry
is.
Carry on.
Okay. So now you've done this. There's all these sort of edge concerns, like maybe they had a special curriculum this interacted with, or Denmark has a very unique preschool system. So what's the next study you want people who are following you to run? What should they do next?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think I would like to see the people who work more closely at the intersection of research and practice think really carefully about how to develop high fidelity assessment. So we could try to find out for individual kids, should they be delaying, or regardless of whether they're delaying or not, what are the appropriate types of curriculum, the appropriate learning environment for that child? Because it's about more than just delay. And I worry as I'm talking this out about parents contorting themselves into anxiety and knots thinking about
that's
this.
Already happening, Tom.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just telling you, there are school districts where you know before your kid is allowed to go to kindergarten, they have to go and have this assessment and they have to know their ABCs or they have to know how to write their name. I'm not making this up. And parents will tutor their kids on just those things. And they're not paying any attention to self-regulation or do they know how to get along with others or can they sit still and listen. They're just worried about the, you know, can they write their name and get the ABCs right? So they're tutoring them for these assessments to get into kindergarten.
Yes. And that sort of parental anxiety, I definitely understand that. I have a child on the cusp of going to college. So I'm steeped in it at the other end of the education pipeline right now.
Right. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Tom D. about redshirting your kindergartner. Do you hold your child back?
So let me make the analogy. So you were saying that what you would like to see researchers do is to come up with better metrics that are both diagnostic and suggest action about whether these kids are ready or not. So a lot of parents – they have children, this is more relevant to your experience, where they might want to do a gap year. They don't want to go – they want to put off a year for college so that they get to go out and get strong experiences that let them understand the world and then they'll see the value of college, let's say.
Right.
Should we make some measures for that too? To like measure whether high school students need a gap year before they go?
Yeah, I think that would be really valuable. Of course, I want to keep my child home just so I could smother him a little more. And,
really?
So wait, let me tell you, this is a true story. There's a kid I know who was redshirted for kindergarten and he took a gap year. So he's starting college at 21. So is that a good thing or a bad thing to start college as a freshman where you're 21, everybody else is 18 or 19?
If he's cool, if he's hip, he'll be really good.
I'm just saying there's lots of, you know, and then think about that kid on the football team. Right? A lot of this redshirting is not necessarily just for academics. It's for, they want them to be able to play basketball and he'll be bigger. It goes back to the Canadian hockey team. So there's a lot of factors here.
You know, I encourage parents to get out of that mindset of the one right answer. You know, because for that kid who's 20 as a college freshman, that might have been the best outcome for that person.
Actually, he says that he's much more prepared for – he was much more prepared for school, elementary school. I mean, how could he know back then? But he – you know, his parents said that. But in college, he feels he's there for the right reason. He got all of his sort of partying out of his system or whatever, and he really is taking classes that he's enjoying because he's there for the right reason.
Right. But I would also stress as this, you know, as we think about should your child go to school or should your college-going child have a gap year, let's not forget we've got other kind of pulleys and levers here. I mean, the other is what are they experiencing when they arrive at kindergarten regardless of age? And, you know, there's this growing awareness and legitimate concern about kindergarten is the new first grade, that the environments have become so structured and academically formal. It may be contributing to the redshirt phenomenon as parents become aware of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The pedagogy of kindergarten because of the testing that goes on. So kindergarten teachers will say to me, I've got to teach that kid to read because in California they take the STAR test in second grade. If he's not reading by first grade, he's never going to be able to do the STAR test in second grade. So the teachers feel they have no choice but to do this.
Right.
It's a problem.
Well, the tests are endlessly a problem. The relentless focus on academics. So it's really important to realize this research study is pointing out that the effect is something you may care more about than whether the kid learns the quadratic equation. And this was sort of the argument around the class size stuff. That everybody I talked to, the class size studies didn't always show benefits on academics. And all the teachers said, you're missing. The smaller class size allows us to spend more time working on the social-emotional development of these kids, and that's where the real benefit was. But the number of steps between social-emotional development and improvement on a test that's designed to measure ABCs is too far for it to show up on those measures.
Right. But this is where the movement to accountability policies that are post No Child Left Behind might be helpful, because the new systems that are emerging under the revised federal guidance often privilege SEL measures, social-emotional learning. So if it was the era of test-based accountability that drove kindergarten to be the new first grade, it may be that these second-generation accountability systems help push back from that a little bit and create a space where educators and principals and communities will see value in more play-based early schooling experiences?
Well, and I know that there's a huge push now to measure social-emotional learning. And part of what you're talking about with self-regulation is definitely part of that. So if we're being asked to measure self-regulation and we're being asked to – and we know that, let's say, the Denmark study holds true, which is a big if, right? As parents, you're going to start to think about what really matters in the grand scheme. Do you want them to know their letters, or do you want them to be able to self-regulate? Do you want them to be social emotionally strong, right? Or do you want them to be on the Canadian hockey team, right? So, so I think it's the keeping the big picture in mind is really important.
Yeah, the consequential validity, which is what is the effect that this test has on society, right? And so one proposal is these SEL tests will reorient people towards these are very important.
SEL being social-emotional learning.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
But the challenge with these kinds of tests, you know, is kind of interesting. So if I ask you what's 2 plus 2?
4. I'm over my math anxiety, Dan.
Yes. no matter what context or what mood you're in and I ask you that, you'll give me 4.
Yeah.
So cognitive stuff is very stable like that. But I give you a test of how much did you like X? Or are you willing to pay attention? Things like that. That's going to depend so much on your mood at the moment.
And the context and the teacher.
That's right.
And
so,
it's
a different – measuring this kind of stuff is different than measuring ABCs.
All right.
So it's an interesting challenge.
So parents, the answer is it depends.
No.
But to focus on the big picture, right? And self-regulation.
If it wasn't for the music, I'd say more.
And trust your judgment.
Trust your judgment. Thank you, Tom. Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on SiriusXM Insight 121.